take up page 72% grant resolution number 19 state affairs, related to resident hire on the United States Department of Defense project. And at Chitka Island, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. It has been through the state affairs committee.
You want to broaden the title?
Your motion on the resolution?
Remove it.
Mrs. Sansky?
Move Nasty Adams, then we move out CS Central, or SJR 19, individual recommendation.
No objection, so done. Okay, let's bring up SB 194, excluding taxi cab operators from unemployment compensation. If you can hear me in Anchorage, we're not to your bill yet. Hang on if you would. CS, the proposed CS percentage bill number 194 that the department wanted, which they feel is better language due to what they intended by the author of the bill. And, anybody wish to testify on 194 today? Senator Jones called me and said he couldn't be here and told me that he would like to come out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Distinguished members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, for the record, my name is Don Kubley, and today I'm here representing the city of Ketchikan, the Gateway Borough, and Yellow Taxi. I'm here today in support of HB 194, or Senate Bill 194. And first, I'd like to give you a brief history of where this legislation came from.
Don, we've already had one hearing on the bill.
It's going to be very brief, Senator. For Senator Euling that wasn't here, just a very quick briefing. The Yellow Cab Company has had a relationship with its drivers for a number of years, going back to the 50s and 60s. That relationship is this. The cab company buys the cars and under a private individual contract with each driver, leases those cars back out to the driver for a percentage of their intake during the day. Those drivers are well aware of their independent contractual situation and have been for a number of years. There's never been any dissatisfaction by the drivers with the relationship, and there's no record of that. For 5 years, from 1980 till 1985, the Department of Labor worked with the Yellow Cab Company auditing their books, and at no time during that five-year period did they express any dissatisfaction with the relationship between the drivers and the owner of the company. After 5 years of approving this relationship, a new bureaucrat was hired within the Department of Labor that reinterpreted the bill, or the
language.
A new public servant was hired who reinterpreted the language of the statute and frankly did it incorrectly. At that time, they informed the cab company that not only was the relationship between them and the drivers redefined, but they would have to pay a fine 2 years back of around $40,000 in back taxes. What this has done, basically, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is to cripple the two biggest cab companies in Juneau, and they're on the verge of going belly up within a matter of days. This is right before some 200 to 300,000 tourists hit town in Ketchikan. It leaves the tourists without taxi services. It leaves the local community members without taxi services. And it all boils down to what they call the ABC test. And I believe it's in your packet. And I would highly recommend, and with all due respect, that the members of the committee read this ABC test, because I think you'll find it as confusing as the members of the Transportation Committee in the House did. And I would like to quote Representative Hudson, who said, the three criteria that made up the DOL's definition of who was an independent contractor was very difficult to understand, as did Chairman Cato. and he said he could understand why there had been confusion in interpreting the criteria, and he said he felt if there was a can of worms, which was referred to by the representative from the Department of Labor, that the confusion was the can of worms, and he suggested that the criteria be rewritten and brought back to the committee. The ABC test that distinguishes a contractual relationship between the owner and the operator, if you do take a chance to read it, is very confusing. And I would, if you ask the representative from the Department of Labor that's here to explain it, I think you'll find the same thing that the Transportation Committee in the House did, which is it's very difficult to understand. The bottom line, gentlemen, is that there's 20 to 30 jobs on the line in Ketchikan that are about to disappear. The cab drivers are not going to have a job because there's not going to be a cab company to hire them. And the city of Ketchikan is going to be left without taxi service. With all due respect, I would hope that the members of the committee could support this legislation that basically, simply, clears up the language so it cannot be misinterpreted by any public servants. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Teleconference on this?
No.
You didn't tell me that they're going to go out of business because they're going to pay 4.03% of the gross wages for unemployment insurance?
Well, what they did, Senator, through the chair, is they came to them and said that they had to pay back taxes to a certain date, 1985, I believe, and that totals a $40,000 bill.
And back taxes or back in unemployment insurance?
Unemployment insurance.
So does this bill retroactively go back and hold them harmless?
We can't do that. What we're hoping is that the commissioner, if this legislation passes, Senator, will re-examine the situation, and he, through an administrative order, can rescind that action. I have talked with him, and he's considering it at this point.
Well, I guess I don't see any. I haven't seen anything that's changed since the bill came before us the last time to indicate two things. One is the department still doesn't support it. And if what you're saying is that the commissioner is going to go back and do it, he'd do it today if he could do it, I assume, or if he was going to do it. But it doesn't sound like he's going to do it. So the company's going to go belly up no matter what happens.
Well, I'm waiting.
Is that the case?
I did not say that the commissioner was going to do it. I said that he was considering it. I talked to him on Friday, and he told me to give him a call back this afternoon. I did that. He was in a meeting. I don't know what his final decision is. His statement was he felt it was very unfair to hit them with a back tax bill in that amount of money when they'd been doing business as usual since 1980 with the Department of Labor. And so as the last I talked to him, Senator, he was considering rescinding the action and forgiving the back taxes. That's where it stood last time I talked to him. And frankly, from the conversation, I felt he was leaning towards rescinding the action.
Thank you.
Is somebody here from the department?
Mr. Chairman, other members of the Senate Finance Committee, my name is Jim Cote. I'm an assistant director with the Employment Security Division and in the program manager of the Unemployment Insurance Program. Since we've testified before, I'm basically here today to answer your questions, but I would like to add a couple things first. Specifically on the case that the gentleman before me mentioned, it is currently in court and would be inappropriate for the department to comment on what actions the court might take in that case. Secondly, in taking a look at it, as you know, employers pay two unemployment taxes, one to the state of Alaska, the one being addressed in this bill, and another to the federal government called the FUTA or FUTA tax. If we made this exception under our law, the FUTA law would raise its current offset tax by 5.4% to a total of 6.2% on this employer. And in fact, it is possible, I don't have the exact numbers, that the individual employer's tax bill could go up under this provision. And of course, the Department of Labor's position stems from the fact that We are not in favor of eliminating from the basic rights of the employee, where the employee-employer relationship exists, the right to unemployment insurance benefits. That's all I really have for additional testimony, if you have any questions at this time.
Any questions? Mike?
I guess what I was trying to figure out, a couple other things. Under the current, maybe they're two different issues, and they are two different issues, but there's no exemption for taxi cab operators for anything else. They pay workman's comp and everything else. Employer pays workman's comp on taxi cab operators right now?
As far as I know, we do have the director of that division here.
Could she answer?
Do you want me to come up, or do you want me to say?
You can say.
It depends on the relationship they have. If they are an employer status, then they are covered by workers' compensation. If they are true independent contractors, and I think that you have something in your packet that says what we look at is the nature of the work test or the surface test. If they fall under independent contractor under that test, then they are not covered by workers' compensation. And we've had cases that have gone both ways.
Would the legislation that's passed, if passed, and signed into law, would it prejudice the position of workman's compensation?
I don't think so. Our tests for independent contractor are separate in law. They aren't totally the same, but reach the same thing. They try to develop whether there's an employer or employee relationship, and if it does exist, they are employees and then covered by both UI and workers' comp. If it does not exist, then there would be no coverage.
Anybody else want to testify this bill?
You know, I'm not enamored by this legislation, but I did indicate to the sponsor that I was looking to go out. I indicated to the committee that I'm with no recommendation on the bill.
I'm not hot on the bill at all, so.
I'll go ahead and move. Yeah, I'll move to an ask unanimous consent and pass that committee substitute bill number.
SB 164, overtime for hospital employees. And is there somebody in Anchorage that wanted to start the testimony off?
This is the Anchorage moderator. We have Sharon Anderson to testify first.
Okay. Ms. Anderson, could you?
Sharon Anderson, I'm with Humana Hospital Alaska here, representing the administration of the hospital. With regard to this bill, the prior wording of this Alaska Wage and Hour Act. With regard to payment of overtime, used to read in line number 16, an employee of a nonprofit hospital. This allowed for many years hospitals in Alaska to base their scheduling on an 80-hour pay period. And this was also consistent, and it continues to be consistent, with the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act relating to hospitals. The hospital did then and still does today pay overtime in excess of 8 hours per day. And we had at that time a pay period based on 14 consecutive days. In 1983, an amendment was offered to delete the term nonprofit from this line to enable all hospitals equal treatment with respect to the overtime law. At that time, Humana entered the healthcare system and was the first proprietary healthcare firm in the state of Alaska. There are several more that are in the state of Alaska at this time. This change was supported by the Alaska State Hospital Association. During the testimony and during the legislative change, the wording was added, whose employment includes the provision of medical services. This took away from many employees. employees to 80 hours per pay period scheduling. Examples would be our dietary employees, housekeeping, admitting registration people, our unit secretaries, folks who work side by side in the laboratory and radiology that were involved in scheduling. Because the hospital is a 24-hour-a-day, 365-day operation, scheduling abilities on an 80-hour per pay period rather than a 40-hour per week are significant. Most hospital employees prefer a 6 or 7 day continual work period to have a contiguous 4 or 5 days off rather than having segmented days off. This is still allowed, however, for our employees and departments that provide medical services. It generally is not at all allowed for, under the current wording, for employees who might work side by side with those employees who don't fit that definition. What has occurred then in order to meet this 40-hour pay period is that many employee schedules were revised to accommodate the restriction. In some instances, such as our dietary department, some employees actually lost hours. Their work week might have been changed to a 32 to a 38 hours per week or a 64 to 70 hours per pay period to avoid the overtime during 40 hours per work week. Housekeeping and some positions, they were broken down. In those instances, we had employees who liked the way the scheduling was based on an 80-hour per pay period, who subsequently were the ones who lost out with regards to scheduling. And in this instance, hospitals do pay overtime on anything that worked in excess of 8 hours a day, so the scheduling impairments were the true result. We did try to work with the Department of Labor during the past few years to try and work out a way where this might be accomplished to allow these employees that which they had before with regard to scheduling. But through the time frame, we were learning that this could not be accomplished without the statutory change back to where we had it in 1983. So we therefore are requesting support for this legislation, which will allow us to go back to the type of scheduling we were able to have in 1983, allow the employees the type of scheduling that is consistent with some of their lifestyles as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Go ahead, Anchorage. Did somebody else want to testify?
Just one moment.
James Sandwich from the Department of Labor. Hold on, Anchorage. We're going to hear from the Department of Labor here in Juneau.
Mr. Chairman, committee, the Department of Labor, when this change was made, the additional language was to create an exemption that made sense with the law. By adding the words, those who enter medical service, essentially folks who in other positions other than in hospital work would remain consistent. Their exemption outside hospital work would probably fall under one of the administrative, executive, or professional exemptions. The folks that would be exempt by this current change in the language as proposed doesn't represent a backward movement to 1983, but instead it increases more the exemption that currently exists. The folks that would be exempted, the housekeeping, maintenance, those kinds of folks, outside the hospital would be treated as non-exempt employees. To create an exemption such as this would add confusion to anybody who moved from one sector to the other. There's no other basis for exempting these people. They do not fit any other exemption under the law. And merely because they work for a hospital, they would be exempt from overtime coverage under the state of Alaska. Ms. Anderson mentioned the 880 pay period. That is something allowed under the federal law, but not under the state law. What an 880 pay period essentially means is I can work you 7 days straight in 1 week without any overtime pay as long as I don't go over 8 in a day or 80 for the total 14 days. So I could work you 10 days straight without a break and without paying you overtime. The exemption sets apart one group of work of the workforce from all their colleagues in other areas of the private industry. They'd still be covered by the federal law, so they still have some overtime requirements, though they wouldn't be as strict as the Alaska requirements. And although the testimony says that it's for the employees, we haven't heard any testimony from employees begging for this exemption.
Any questions?
Senator Matsky.
I have to somewhat apologize to the folks that were on there. I was trying to read over my file at the same time, and maybe I got a little, I'll be a little redundant over what was previously indicated, but the 1983 change in the law was done by who or what?
Well, originally there was a request that the exemption be moved from, it used to read that employees of nonprofit hospitals would be exempt from coverage.
Coverage of what, overtime?
Of overtime. And I must assume, since that was long before my time, that that was sort of a way to subsidize a nonprofit hospital to allow them to exist in an economic environment where they otherwise might be not exist. In 83, it was changed so the language read that it exempted employees of hospitals that provided medical service. And those people that provide medical service would be the folks that outside the hospital industry would also generally qualify for an overtime exemption under a professional, administrative, or executive capacity in some other private industry.
I hate to tell you this, but I am a little bit confused. Is the chairman following it?
No, I'm confused too. This exemption only pertains to people employed by a hospital.
That's correct.
So what does this talk about outside of hospitals?
Well, when you look at exemption, you try to make the exemptions consistent throughout a person's range of employment. If I was a professional employee of, say, ARCO, I would be exempt under the overtime law. If I went into working for a hospital, I would still be exempt. However, if I was a janitor for ARCO, I would not be exempt under the law. But if I suddenly went to work for a hospital, I would now be exempt.
So what we're saying now under the law is that medical service personnel that work for a hospital have a special enough reason be allowed to work different time shifts, right? And what they're asking for is that people that work for the hospital that aren't directly related to medical services also be given that type of ability. The hospital wants that type of flexibility.
Well, we do have a flexible work hour plan that would allow them to work 8 days straight, working 4 tens with 2 weeks back to back. And that would allow them to work 80 hours in 8 straight days with no overtime liability under a current state law.
Okay, why don't you hang on one second, Mike?
Okay, next speaker in Anchorage, please.
Good evening. My name is Nessa Ho. I work at Savannah Hospital. I have been working at the Alaska Hospital for about 16 and a half years. At one time, I was able to work a schedule of 80 hours per pay period rather than 40-hour work week, and this allowed my schedule to be where I had 4 days off in a row, or 2 days off, whichever was most desirable for me. But when the law was changed in 1983, I was no longer had this type of schedule available to me, and I have always been paid overtime for working 8 hours a day. The ability to have my schedule considered for the entire 80-hour pay period rather than the 40-hour work week is most preferable to me. Having 2 days off during the week is so much nicer, you know, family-wise than with 1 day off a week, and plus we have a better working schedule. Please vote for this in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Can you explain, could you tell us your name again, please, and
yes,
exactly
Ms.
what you do?
N-I-N-S-A.
And what do you do at the hospital?
I worked as a unit secretary for the last 7 years on the orthopedic floor.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, go ahead, Anchorage. Next speaker. We're waiting for somebody to say the department.
Hi, I'm Debbie Wagenshut, and I'm in speaking in supporting of the Senate Bill 164 relating overtime for hospital employees. I have been an employee of Alaska Hospital, and now I am an employee of Humana Hospital. And I've been employed with a total number of right around 4 years. I had left the Alaska Hospital in 1981, and then I had just come back this year. And back in 81, I did have the choice, I guess, of having my schedule for the 80-hour pay period rather than the 40-hour work week. And since I've come back to work and I'm on the 40-hour work week, I really, you know, I prefer the 80-hour pay period. It gives me a chance to create a schedule that suits me for my home, and plus it also helps the employer of Humana Hospital for scheduling. I know that my employer had tried to work out a good schedule for me with a 40-hour week, but I would prefer the 80-hour pay period. Please vote in favor of this bill. I'm sure there's other people out there just like I who would probably prefer the 80-hour pay period work week. Thank you so much.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Hey, Debbie, Senator Szymanski, I'm kind of curious. What do you envision as an 80-hour pay period?
When I used to work for Alaska Hospital, I had the choice of working a schedule to where I could be home if I chose for 4 days straight, or if I could have my 2 days off together. Instead, now I'm working a five-day stretch with a day off, and working seven with a three-day off. And it's nice, but those long stretches get to you, and I prefer to have my choice of what my days off are.
So you'd like to work 10 straight days?
If I chose, in case, since my family lives out of state, and it's just my husband and my children up here, and if I prefer, I could, you know, be able to go out and see them, you know, and work a schedule that's suitable for me plus my employer.
Okay, now, if it's my understanding that if you work under the current law 7 days, and I got the Department of Labor sitting here, at the end of the fourth day, or the fifth day, assuming you're 8 hours a day, you're picking up minimum time and a half after the fifth day.
No, the way the week schedule is Saturday to Sunday. And in essence, what it does is I have my 2 days off are split 1 week, and then I have a double where they're both together on the next week together at the end and the beginning.
So you don't get any overtime?
No. I just work an 8-hour day.
And you're doing that now?
Yes.
I don't know you can do that legally.
It's possible if they split the pay rate correctly, Senator, that you can work
more than 40 hours a week in any given 7 day stretch. It's depending on how you where your week begins and your week stops.
So I see. What you're doing is you take the end of your 1 week and you're starting the other is back to back.
Yeah.
And you split them down. I see what you're doing. Okay. And I guess back to the department then on that. If we were to pass this, it doesn't seem to me why we would not exempt everybody from it. In other words, why do we have the law on the books in the first place?
I don't know. I guess that'd be a good question to ask.
I don't know. I'll ask the department on that one. Mm-hmm. Why just pick out hospitals? It might as well be McDonald's, or it might as well be shoe salesmen.
Senator, through the chair. The reason, again, back to the idea of who is exempt or not exempt from the law, a lot of it's based on, I guess, market economics. Some people in certain positions have the training and the ability to negotiate a good deal, so to speak, or at least have the ability, because they have a smaller amount of the supply in the market, to make a better negotiation position. Other positions don't have that favorable market position, and thus, if you will, perhaps need more of a protection from being exploited by the state. So the state steps in, or the federal government steps in, and sets up who is exempt, who isn't. And that's usually based on what the job duties entail, as far as skill levels, training levels, that sort of thing. The current exemption exempts those people in those high skill categories that have higher amounts of training, better market position, whereas the exemption that they're asking for would add into that all those people who don't fit into that category. And like you say, the person working at McDonald's or Sears as a janitor would be treated differently if they were a janitor in the hospital, without really having duties that are greatly different.
Well, we have a little different situation in the hospital where you have to have 24-hour coverage of certain duties if people die. Hospitals are special things. You can't relate a hospital to McDonald's. McDonald's closes at 11 o'clock at night. You don't get a burger until 11 the next morning. Not true of a hospital.
But the question of scheduling, as I mentioned before, the current flexible work schedule allows them to do exactly what they're asking, and that's to work people 8 days straight without overtime liability.
Okay, so what we have is something that used to be that was changed by law, and the employees we've heard from to date said they want to change that. Have we heard any opposition to this bill? Did the HES committee hear any opposition to this bill? So right now we have the workers saying we want this, and we have the Department of Labor saying it's not in their best interest to have it.
I think that's pretty accurate, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just look at Commissioner Sampson's last paragraph of his position paper, and he states that the provisions of 164 are contrary to the interest of Alaska workers and department is opposed to. But we really haven't seen tangible evidence that it's contrary to the interest of Alaska workers.
Yeah, but I tell you what I think we should do is, since this is the first hearing we're having on the bill, we should give somebody the opportunity to prove to us that it is in their worst interest. So we should probably do a full bill until next hearing. Okay, but as of now, I'm inclined to go along with the bill because the people we have heard from say they'd like to go back to the old way. Okay, we'll call it. Meeting here on SB 164 off as of now. We'll bring it up again next week. Senator, are you coming back later?
Just a second.
Okay, Senate Bill 81, relating to the Alaska Power Authority. Senator Zorn, you want to tell us what you see on today?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Phil, and I work for Senator Giroff. The two main objectives of Committee Substitute Senate Bill 81 are, number one, to clarify that APA staff are, in fact, in the exempt service, and number two, to change the composition of the APA board. It is the feeling of Senator Giroff he would prefer to see restructuring of the board, in effect, to depoliticize the board and to provide for long-term stability. His proposal would create a 7-member board serving 6-year staggered terms. Composition of the board would be reflected as follows: Commissioner of DCED and the Commissioner of Revenue, one director from banking industry, one consumer representative, 2 directors from business and industry, and 1 director experienced in the electrical utility industry. The relevant sections dealing with the exempt service for staff of the APA, that occurs in Section 1 and 4. Section 2 and 3 of the proposed committee substitute deal with the restructuring of the board. Depending on what the pleasure of the committee is, there is one technical change I wish to reference, and that occurs in the transition section of the bill, which is Section 5, page 2, line 21. It would be necessary to delete the reference to 3 commissioners and insert the reference to 2, predicated on what the current board structure is. You'd only be replacing 2 commissioners.
Okay. Change?
Yes, sir. Following from the policy change within the change of the board structure.
Okay. So what we have is an original long bill that's been essentially boiled down to I don't think anybody questioned the exempt service in the last go around, so the policy call is Section 2 of the membership of the board. Any questions? Mr. Laresh, this way you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Power Authority Board of Directors has taken a position in favor of the exempt section, and I could explain that if you needed it explained, but your last comment implied that you don't.
Section 1.
Yeah, Section 1. Basically, apparently at some time in the past, a couple employees who were fired went to court and said they weren't really exempt because they weren't listed, or the power authority staff was not listed in the statutes as an exempt agency. Therefore, they couldn't be let go in the fashion they were. The court found that due to some legislative history of the Power Authority Organic Act, I guess, these people were in fact exempt. And following that court case, the AG did recommend that their exemption be put explicitly into law, along with the other agencies which are statutorily exempt. And the Power Authority Board recommend that this be done to avoid any future such confusion. The board did not take a position in support of restructuring itself. The board felt, I wasn't at the meeting, but apparently the board felt that the present existence of the board keeps the proper checks and balances between the power authority, which is, of course, a corporation of the state, the executive branch, and the legislative branch, and they recommended that this not be tinkered with. And, of course, the basic issue here, and I should say it in so many words, is does or does not the administration control the vote on the Power Authority Board? The way it exists today, the executive branch does have that control. With this, the control would be in the hands of public members who would thereby take on a large share of the authorities of the Power Authority to issue large amounts of bonds to push certain projects in the legislature. And the present board apparently felt that was not in the best public interest.
What's the current makeup of the board? Not the name
of the division? Four members who are, I think, statutorily the only statutory one is the director of OMB, or is his or her designee, and then three commissioners of principal departments appointed by the governor, plus three public members.
Right now,
I don't know, but
four-year
terms. I think, are they four-year terms explicitly, not
all those governors,
not as of a pleasure?
I don't think there are any specific terms set out in terms of the commissioner appointees.
Right.
They're standard. But for the public members that are appointed by the governor,
they're four-year staggered terms.
Well, it'd be Senator Zaros thought that the directors who are not commissioners would then serve for six-year staggered terms to give the long-term stability. But the governor would still have the problem within the two commissioners that would serve on the board at the pleasure of the governor.
I think I must have missed the first hearing on this, so I want to, if I could, go back and maybe ask a question on the exemption status. Does the exemption status, when granted, exempt you from all, I don't know, what exactly do you see it as, what does it exempt you from? Prevailing wages or?
All state personnel rules. People are hired at a step in a range as determined by the executive director with the approval of the board.
So what about your compensation?
My compensation is established by the board.
By the board. But even under exemption or non-exemption, it doesn't make any difference.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, if they were partially exempt, I assume that it'd be all the same, except it'd be harder to let somebody go.
There are several exemptions that you can see there that you just have. Well, the bill goes from here, it goes to finance, where Senator Zaroff has his opportunity to put it on. So the question, I guess, as we call it in here, is that this committee feels that from the current makeup on four-year terms to the new makeup of six-year terms.
What again, Mr. Chairman, what again is the reason for going to six-year?
It
if I may, through the chair, it's my understanding that the kind of the track record for the Power Authority board members indicated there really isn't any long-term stability. I think someone has tried to figure the average, and it runs about 2 years for appointees across the board. I've heard that testimony before. And the concept that Senator Jarup wishes to achieve is to have long-term stability out there, free from some of the political pressures.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Well, for the record, I have a tendency to support the legislation with regard to the longer terms. I think Senator Zarup has touched on a problem that many of us, as even legislators, have had, that projects are very long in duration, both in the development stage and then ultimately the projects themselves when they go to construction. And continuity seems to be sometimes lacking in historical knowledge of what's going on. I guess I'm still not really sure as to why the board is not seeing that same, sharing at least some of their thoughts or maybe my concern on that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Szymanski, I disagree that the average term of the public board members has been all that short. I mean, Mr. Allison's been on it for two terms, which has been 8 years, or will be 8 years by the time he's off, as has Colonel Nunn. I think he will have served 8 years. Huffman, who's the third public board member, and I suspect he's still in his first term. But the public members have lasted at least 4 years. It's the members appointed from administrations who, of course, come and go, as those people in those positions tend to from anything.
But when I think back in history over the changing of several administrations, the policies that have shifted between them, whether it was the Hammond administration to the newer administration, so forth, I'm not too sure we don't want to force them into a little more institutional thinking. But I don't know. See how it flies. Turn the flagpole.
Well, the intention of the committee to move the bill out today, so it comes down to what we've got. Does anybody object to doing that? Does anybody object to doing that? Membership of the authority changes. I would object to that.
I object to that, too.
So then with the concurrence of Senator Szymanski, we'll just take Section 1 and move the bill out and see what they want to do about the finances.
Moving on down the line.
So then, Senator, we need a motion to adopt Section 1 of the emergency asset and Section 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move and ask unanimous consent that, first of all, we adopt Committee Substitute Consent Bill number 81, and then I'll move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt Committee Substitute Consent Bill number 81, Labor and Commerce, with only Section 1.
And Section 4 and number 3.
And Section 4 and number 3.
And Section 6 and the amendment. Any objection? So that is there a motion to move it on today?
So moved.
Any objections to moving Committee Substitute Bill number 81?
Yeah, Freddie gets it now. That's the long
surprise. You need to be on this boat.
We need to get out.
You want to move this bill out?
Well, we're going to move that. Okay, sponsor substitute to Senate Bill number 39 drawn off. And do you want to have the word by request?
Well, it would be. For the record, Mr. Chairman, Michael Phil works for Senator Zaroff. The intention of Senator Zaroff, his preference would be to have a committee substitute drawn up. However, in the interest of time, if it were necessary to function from a sponsor substitute, he would like that sponsor substitute to read by request.
Well,
you
haven't had a CFI.
Yes, sir, if that was the pleasure of the committee.
Okay. I should put on the record that I received a call from Mitch Bravo, lobbyist for the Alaska Realtors, and they have indicated their support for the proposed.
For the record, I'm Becky Bear. I'm legislative liaison for the Department of Commerce. Okay. I'm not going to go through a whole step-by-step on this, but basically this is the sunset year of the Real Estate Commission. And as the department has looked at the Real Estate Commission and the problems associated with the fact that we have had a precipitous drop in realtors in the state and that the commission is unable to be self-supporting as it is currently constructed, and that by bringing them in as a as a commission in the Division of Occupational Licensing, we can affect some economies of scale, which would mean that we'd be able to save $152,000 in the operation of the commission in this current year. And by that means, make them self-supporting, that we can provide them regulatory and statutory revision support because we have the personnel on staff in our Division of Occupational Licensing, and also because we can provide them administrative support in areas they are doing themselves. We feel this is the most effective way to do it. I point out to the committee that in 1980, when the commission was given a separate entity status, this legislature specifically said that they were trying to an experiment to see if the commission would function more cost-effectively and more efficiently as a separate commission. And we feel at this time that the indication is that they would function more cost-effectively and efficiently as part of the Division of Occupational Licensing.
Thank you, Becky. Anybody else with this time of bill? Is Occupational Licensing in favor of it as written?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Did we change the fee in this, yes?
No.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jackie McClintock, Director of the Workers' Compensation Division. I haven't seen the committee substitute, but I assume that Section 10 or whatever it was about workers' compensation is still in the bill. Is that correct? It's gone. I have no testimony to give. I'm sorry. I looked for a committee substitute today.
Did you have an objection to see your job
removed? That is correct if that section is gone.
Anybody else wish to testify? Yes.
I just want to reiterate that the Alaska Association of Realtors does support this bill, and I am prepared to read a statement if you'd like me to at this time. I can make it real quick with a voice like this. I'm not going to take very long.
See how long that lasts. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Peggy Ann McConaughey, and I am here on behalf of the Alaska Association of Realtors. The Alaska Association of Realtors does support the administrative reorganization contained in sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 39. The association believes that the transfer of the administrative functions of the Real Estate Commission to the Division of Occupational Licensing will address the first of two major issues that identified by the association as needing attention at this time. The Alaska Association of Realtors, as articulated in its 1987 and 88 Statement of Legislative Policy, supports an efficient and involved real estate commission. Due to the current economic conditions, the number of real estate licensees is declining. As the commission's budget is now based on program receipts, it is necessary to find means by which delivery of services to licensees can be maintained to the greatest possible degree within current and projected revenues. It is our view that sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 39 will achieve this objective. Based on thorough discussions of the proposal with the Director of Occupational Licensing, we believe transfer of the Commission's administrative, investigative, and licensing functions to the Division will improve operational efficiency. At the same time, the proposal will assist the Real Estate Commission to focus on areas of critical concern to Alaska's realtors in good times as well as bad, specifically more careful review of surety fund and license violation claims and the continuation of development and delivery of cost-effective and meaningful educational programs for licensees and the public. Therefore, the Alaska Association of Realtors requests the Labor and Commerce Committee's early and favorable action on the bill as its passage during the session is viewed by the association as critical. both from the standpoint of continuing the existence of the Real Estate Commission and maintaining the benefits to the industry and the public we believe it will facilitate. The second major issue of concern to the association not addressed in the bill is a thorough review and revision of portions of the real estate statutes. The Alaska Association of Realtors has worked actively with the Commission since 1984, studying existing statutes and regulations and making recommendations for changes. A bill embodying some of those changes, SB 487, was introduced late in the 1986 session. Due to time constraints and more pressing legislative priorities, the only action taken by the legislature in 1986 was to extend the existence of the Commission for 1 year past its statutory sunset date. The passage of sponsor substitute for SB 39 would require that the statutory and regulatory review be done in light of the new administrative organization. In the new administrative position paper on sponsor substitute for SB 39, the Department of Commerce acknowledges the need for such review, and the association would expect that the commitment by the department to continue the effort to make necessary modifications to the real estate licensing statutes would result in the introduction of legislation in 1988. The Alaska Association of Realtors in turn pledges its continued involvement in this area to work closely with the department during the interim to develop additional legislative proposals for your review in 1988. Chris Foster, Vice President of the Alaska Association of Realtors, is here with me today, and we'd be more than happy to answer more detailed questions in a voice a little bit better than mine. Thank you.
I'd like to defer to Kathy because she worked the figures up.
My name is Kathy Marshall. I'm the Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing, and the division prepared the fiscal note. The fiscal note is based on savings of, I'm going to pull this out. The savings of $62,000 in personal services, that's by reclassifying the executive director's position to an executive secretary, which would be more in line with how we already function. We have an executive secretary for the nursing board, for example. It also reduces the publication specialist to half-time, and those are the major things in personal services. It makes some cuts in contractual and travel that would bring the commission more in line with the kinds of expenditures we already have associated with, like the medical board and the nursing board. We've reviewed this proposal with the commission, and they don't seem to see, the director didn't seem to think there was a major problem with it. The problem that we see is this savings is really a paper savings in that the commission this year has not been able to generate the program receipts that they needed to cover their expenditures. So what we're doing is we're bringing them into line with what they can generate in licensing fees, and that will enable them to be self-supporting.
Okay, any questions?
I'm going to ask the assembly about the CS.
Also, if we need an immediate effective date?
It would be helpful.
Yeah. With immediate effective date.
Okay, the motion is to adopt the CS with immediate effective date. Objection, so then the motion to adopt the date.
So moved.
So CS Senate Bill 39 moved by the table. I'll get one thing. I'm really nervous about sending an APSC bill over to the House of the White House. An APA bill over to the House of the White House.
Does
it have
another committee? Do you want to hold it?
Well, but it's going to go to Fred Farrell. You just maybe want to attach a note to it.
Well, we're going to put that in the final version. I think we're going to interact with the title.
But he didn't change the title anyway. No, you guys just filmed me, and I'm on the other side. I was ready on this one.
You need your signatures.